This is a production of Cornell University.
One of the great parts of this gig here at Cornell is going in and out of the city every once in a while. New York City is a fascinating place where grass meets people. And I got a chance to walk on, as the moonlight was out, the old Lincoln Center roof that I worked on many years ago, back in 2009, when they built this roof and put the grass on it a number of years ago. It was just a beautiful night, and wandered around Central Park with Zach Holmes on Tuesday. Very interesting landscape management there, of which sports turf is involved. And you know, Carl, we can't start out without something ridiculous, right? Who knows what happened? You hope nobody was hurt. This guy looks like he went off off the road or off an embankment or hit the wrong button. And the guy says maybe he didn't like our pin placements that day. So you never know with these kinds of things. You know, Carl, we've been talking a lot about putting animals to work. This has been a common trend. This guy doesn't look so happy about it this time. Maybe he didn't get a good night's sleep or whatever, but he's not thrilled about having to work. And then a big melancholy shout out to Tom Kaplan, the current president of NYSTA, just had to put his dog down. This is a big thing in our industry, with the connection between dogs and our work life and our personal life and our emotional well-being. And when these things happen, it's always good to share it with each other. As a person who didn't grow up with a dog, but then had a dog, I sort of realized, man, this thing hits pretty hard when it does. And just in case anybody was wondering whether I won the pie in the face contest, thanks to everybody who contributed to this ridiculousness, we raised $600 for the Farm Net group here at Cornell. And as a member of the Ag Science faculty here, I was happy to do it with my colleague, Mike Van Amberg in Dairy Science. All right, Carl, I'm going to do the weather quick. We're going to do the rant, and then we're going to get right into a little bit of me to set up our conversation with Chase. Sorry. Soils are still pretty cool, I got to say. You know, things are growing for sure. But when you look at our soil temperature data, you know, just from a few days ago, you can see we're still in the upper 40s, mid 50s. The 60s have moved down only into the Delmarva Peninsula, really. And last week, of course, was cooler than normal, right? When you look at the departure, you see it very cool along the coast. But the big story this spring has been the rain. And I don't know what's going on in the South, Chase, but we are sort of saturated. We are half saturated here. And, you know, as we get the conversation, this has to be an element of a conversation with the kind of field you choose to use. No matter what web of decision-making you have to navigate, or map of decision-making you have to navigate, when it comes to climate change, and I know it's mentioned in your proposal that we'll talk about later, but this is, of course, something to consider, because you're in the heat of the spring sports season now, right? Up here where we are, we're in the heat of the spring sports season. Now, the other thing is, you know, we don't go crazy about this, but, you know, we're a few weeks behind last year, maybe only a week or so behind normal, but this is going to change pretty quick, and we'll talk about this in a minute. If you look at Carl's growth model that he's built here on the forecast website, Carl, I got to remember to put the QR code up there so people can see this. But if you are listening on the podcast, the forecast website really has this wonderful growth model that picked up the little bit of blip in growth we got last week. And we saw it really in the research plots as well. Nice blip of growth. But you see that's returned to very slow growth. And it looks like forecasts for the next few days are going to be slow as well. Now, as we heard this morning on our weekly conference call, it looks like it's going to be warm and dry for a couple of weeks. This is a very interesting pattern. We went into a prolonged dry period. Art wasn't willing to put his neck on the line for going longer than 8 to 10 days, but certainly a period where we're going to get some dry weather. Now, the other part I can't leave you without thinking about, our risk assessment tool on the forecast website. It looks like as you get south, the red risk is growing. And if you look carefully at our weed control, where we recommend the 2,4-D applications in the spring based on degree day models, you can see it's also moving into that same area. So this is exactly what we're talking about. And Carl, you raised a really good point over the week when we were chatting about this. You know, you see what happens when you get obsessed with grass. Every place you walk and go, you see these things everywhere. You take a picture. The people just finished mowing this lawn by our botanic garden, probably at 3.5 inches, and it still remains filled with flowers. Now, that's not really the topic of today, nor is this ridiculousness. at Real Madrid Stadium, Chase. I don't know if you've had a chance to see this craziness, but this is some other level hydraulic meeting of controlled environment agriculture, vertical agriculture with sports turf, of all things. And Carl, as we sort of get to your rant, that's the setup for today. We hear a lot about these surfaces. Look at the lengths we go to give them a natural grass surface, Carl. What else is involved here?
Yeah, right. So we're always talking about field safety, right, Frank, and how we can manage the fields specifically to meet these certain thresholds or benchmarks, whether it's traction or firmness or ball roll or ball bounce, however we choose to measure it. But ultimately, the athlete is still interacting with the surface with some sort of footwear on their foot, right? And we talked about this a bit with Andy McNitt in past episodes, but that selection of footwear is really important in how it pertains to their performance and their safety on the field. So you can just, it doesn't take very long to figure out that people have been trying to optimize footwear for athletes for a long time. You look at some of the research in running where how the collar fits on your ankle changes your gait and how you decelerate and turn. The midsole thickness apparently is a big factor, and how thick that sort of shoe sole is influences how the energy transfers up your leg while you're running. So it can have an injury risk. It can also have a performance aspect. And then they also look at, hey, when you're running on concrete versus a rubber track, you should pick shoes that have different sort of sole depths, right? If you're on a unforgiving surface like concrete, you need a larger depth because you don't want all that energy going back up into your knee and your hip and elevating your injury risk. So, right, shoes matter for performance and for safety. Andy McNitt has looked at this a bunch, and we've talked about the sort of traction elements of footwear, and he's looked at studies with this, and now they have their traction database basically saying, hey, when you select a footwear that has a certain traction sort of component, it's going to affect your injury risk, especially based on the field. So they've got this traction database at the Penn State website, Bermuda grass, Kentucky bluegrass, field turf, and they will give you the traction values of specific footwear types. And what they say is, hey, the highest traction value may be good for performance. You can stick your foot in the ground and change direction really quickly, but that also increases your injury risk, right? If that shoe's not going to give, something in that system is going to give, and it's probably your ankle or your knee, right? If you're an athlete who can generate a lot of force but can't then move, you don't want to select a really high traction shoe. So you got to find something in the middle that matches also the traction of the surfaces you're playing on, right? So there's the interaction between the surface and the footwear. And we also know people are different too, right, Frank? And we've done a little bit of research with footwear and putting surfaces, and we find that different people cause different amounts of disruption to putting surfaces, right? You can see here, if you're watching, subject A creates a lot more visual disruption to the putting surface than subject B. That's because they walk a little bit differently, right? And how they apply force into the ground is different. So all this would say, hey, if I'm a professional athlete and I want to maximize performance, but I also want to minimize my injury risk, I should probably have a really sort of in-depth, detailed way to choose my shoes on game day, right? At the NFL level, these are organizations valued, I don't know, $5 to $10 billion. Surely there is someone on staff who can select footwear based on the game day field and the athletes that are in that field. But I saw this video a couple months ago. This is from Hard Knocks, a documentary series. They followed the Miami Dolphins last year and before the playoff game in Kansas City. Here's their running backs coach. And in the video, he's talking to the running backs in the room. He says, hey, guys, it's going to look like a green field, but it's painted dirt. Okay. It's painted dirt. That's what it is. So make sure you take a couple pairs of shoes. Right? And there's two things that I don't like about this, Frank. One, this is Arrowhead Stadium. Travis Hogan, generally regarded as the gold standard of sports turf managers, right? I think everybody in the industry, that field, that staff is sort of the level that we all aspire to. So that's one thing, calling this just painted grass or painted dirt. The second thing is he's leaving this decision about what footwear to choose up to the athletes. And they will always choose the highest traction shoe because it maximizes performance. They shouldn't have to go through a bunch of literature and figure out, okay, which one's the best for injury risk though? And how should I measure the field before? There should be somebody on staff who's making that decision during the games. And maybe there is, and maybe this quote is taken out of context, but man, it feels like this is a coach just saying, hey guys, you got some shoes at home, bring a couple. Run around a little bit and you'll figure it out. And that, man, that does not seem like a wise thing when you've got that amount of stakes, that amount of competition, that amount of money involved. Yeah. Yeah. In professional sports.
Yeah. So, and so there's the rant, right? The rant is this should be safety equipment, not something a running backs coach is advising unless he's got a brief to address this particular issue. Because I think it's funny, right? When you think about that, Carl, how little it appears, and of course, we could be taking this out of context, it appears not much thought seems to be given, even though I've heard from John Sorokin and Andy that they put signs in the locker rooms at these things about the kinds of footwear that they recommend and things. Now, it seems odd to me when data is such a part of the game, right? The analytics of like just a soccer game, where on the field the action is taking. Chase has looked into this over the years, but there's also the strategy of the way you want to play and where the traffic winds up being concentrated. Now, Chase, this is interesting, right? Because you did a lot of work in this area. This is where I want to start with. We sort of set up, I sort of saw what Carl was going to do. I was like, oh, this is a perfect setup for our pal Chase. Okay. The footwear might be a hidden risk we don't think about, but you've identified there's a lot of variability in the field. And in your real great work, right? You basically said, listen, there's a lot of things that vary, but the important stuff like soil moisture and hardness don't really vary much over the course of a tournament or when you want something to perform. It depends on how wet it is going in or the existing variability in the field. So, no matter how it happens, there's going to be some out there over a period of time. If you had to reconcile footwear and inconsistencies, let's start at the highest level where they strive to make them uniform. Do you think those inconsistencies are perceptible by the athlete or in some ways also contributing to the equation?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on, guys. Appreciate it. Always fun. Yeah, I haven't seen this figure in a long time.
Yeah.
but yeah, this is some of my early work.
Yeah.
It depends, Frank. I think when we talk professional sports, it's so different now with the lay and play side and how much they're renovating the field so frequently. I don't know the degree of within field variability at that level, you know. But when you're talking about some of the community level fields that I work on, I mean, even collegiate level fields, they're not renovating as frequently as the
Right.
professionals. I do think there's a degree of within field variability. I think as long as you have 100% grass cover, that probably doesn't get into the athlete's head. But if you're on a high school level natural grass, natural soil, native soil field, if we've done research, we've interviewed athletes, they recognize when there's no grass cover or thin grass cover, and they actually do adjust the way that they behave. And I would
Okay.
assume that their footwear and footing would do that too. We haven't looked at that specifically, but I would assume that it would
Okay.
interact differently.
All right, good. Okay. Sorry to be a blast from the past, but this
No,
is
you're good.
but that variability that you identified is exactly what we wanted to say is at the highest level, maybe this isn't an issue. And those guys really need to think about footwear because the fields are as good as we can get them at that level, one would hope. But this is a pretty good example of what an average community field will look like in August when the players get back and you've got crabgrass filling in there, going to be going to flower soon. Now, over the years, Chase, we've sort of tried to address this on our sports turf website. We have this very simple tool that I've used with school boards a couple of times and gone around with the ground staff and talked about sort of how would you rate this? Have the guy ask a question, make sure they understood what the grounds manager knew, start to create this community dynamic. And then Carl passes along this, and I know he passed it on to you. I want to start sort of with like the gold standard. We're not entirely sure who did this work, so eventually we'll just put it out there and see where all this came from. But a school district in California, Fremont, California, it looks like, presented something back in 2020 in the fall. About a synthetic turf versus natural grass. This is an incredibly elaborate presentation, of which the only thing that immediately jumped out worthy of our discussion here is not all traffic is the same. We don't really know how to quantify it. That's what this graph is saying. But an hour of baseball is different than an hour of field hockey. An hour of softball is different than an hour of rugby, right? When it comes to the amount of wear and tear the fields should be able to, or, you know, are going to have to handle. And Carl, we think about this like with rounds of golf too, a much easier measure in some ways to determine, especially with Nikolai's work years ago that we're going to validate this summer, that the majority of the steps on a putting green happen right around the hole location. So we know not all traffic is the same. And so you have all these variables, Chase. Here's this great title of the proposal that you're doing. And in the background is Joe Magliocca's field down in Elmira City School District. Exactly the kinds of fields that you and I sort of have to, we work with all the time. We don't work at the highest levels where they have, where money's not an object, but it's not just about the money, right? When you look at this proposal, and I'm putting this up here so everybody else can glaze over at the amount of illogic that's going into trying to determine how to solve field problems, help communities answer the question, is natural turf or synthetic turf a better option? And in the meantime, navigate the web of communication. This, I think, Chase, really depicts the project here. So let's start right here with the conversation, right? We think about footwear. We think about field quality. You've already passed the comment. Just give me full grass cover. And when we three talk and the people that might be listening think, okay, well, how hard is that? That doesn't seem hard. You know, Ben Palmer puts them on sneakers in the spring, right? To not put as much wear and tear. Okay, why is this so hard? Because Carl and I also know how hard this is. But talk a little bit about navigating something that seems simple, like just get really good grass cover and should be able to hold up to a certain amount of wear and tear, and getting that executed on many of the communities throughout the country?
That's a loaded question.
You bet it, buddy. That's why we paid a big bucks to be here, buddy.
I mean, it all boils down to funding, and that's going to be related to having some professional sports turf manager to hire somebody who's knowledgeable in how to do that.
Is that the first step? Is that it? If you had to boil it down to the key to making this happen, is it making sure they can attract somebody who knows like they do what they're doing, just like they do for HVAC systems and other systems in facility operations? How come we can't get it viewed as a trade like that if that's the key? Is it the key, and how come?
Yeah, I think so. And it's because you have somebody knowledgeable on how to, and this is true for synthetic turf maintenance too. Mm-hmm. You have somebody knowledgeable on what it takes to properly maintain the field rather than somebody who doesn't. And so they're going to be the one who's getting educated, hopefully attending things like this,
okay,
keeping up with the industry. And they're going to be the resource on, okay, how do we provide the safe playable fields? And that's for all field types.
Okay. So, as I said, you know, the weather's not so good and we got a lot of kids want to play sports, and we got a lot of native soil fields up this neck of the woods. I would say the frequency of questions we're getting in New York, outside of New York, nationally, from concerned people, not necessarily people in the management business, that when which we deal with regularly, but a different level of sort of advocacy, that they're against synthetic turf. They've sort of turned on synthetic turf now, the preponderance of synthetic turf systems. So when you try to navigate this thing in your mind, as you see this grant unfolding, what do you think are the keys that you're going to develop in this grant that are going to be important for informing that decision, that even if somebody wanted to think about it now, what are some of the things that are going to come out of this work and you think people should be considering that are keys in that discussion at the community level?
Well, I think one thing is, you know, we're turf grass scientists, right? The three of us. But at the same time, we're researchers, and our job is to provide unbiased data to stakeholders to benefit their job. And so with that perspective, we have to do a fair assessment on natural grass versus synthetic turf in all aspects of what we're evaluating in that study. And, you know, so our initial submission was last year, and that was a knock on it, is we were too pro grass. And when I first got that comment from a reviewer that we need to be more unbiased, I was like, really? This is USDA, yada, yada. And I was kind of upset about it. But after sitting on it for a year and having to reformat this proposal, you know, I get now why they want that. They can't invest a lot of money when our initial, we have an initial bias already, that we want to, that grass is going to be the best. It was obvious the way that we first written it. So we reformatted it. We've pulled in industry people from every side. And we're truly coming at it from a more unbiased approach. And that's going to benefit everybody, because we're going to have factual information. None of these numbers are going to be leaning one way or the other. They are what they are. Right. And we have people now on board that's going to help us balance that. So I think that was top priority with the resubmission. Now within that, I mean, all the factors that we're trying to consider in the study, I mean, we're looking at environmental factors, safety, costs, obviously, and one field type will probably be beneficial in one scenario and another field type will be beneficial in another. So it's not going to be so cut and dry. No. But nonetheless, we need to provide unbiased information so that people can make the decisions that's best for themselves. I mean, when you talk about professional level fields, you know, they're a completely different world than community yeah. level fields, and yeah. all the variability in community level fields is so extreme. Yeah. So just to be able to provide large scale, unbiased information about all field types, covering all components of community level sports fields, is our goal, so that they can make the decisions for themselves. It's not natural grass versus synthetic turf. It's just that's that right. they have the information
right.
they need.
That's exactly right. So, and here is, you know, what a extension scientist who doesn't do too much research in this area generally tells people, especially with a spring like this. With the amount of kids that want to play, you got two options. If you have natural grass and you got, you know, 200% normal rainfall, you better have a lot of extra fields where you're going to have to sacrifice and move them around to a certain extent, even if they're built out of sand, right? If you don't rotate them or reline them or move them around, if you get this kind of weather, you're going to see significant damage, right? So this is where I'd say this is a time where access to some synthetic turf is really valuable. In the summertime, I'd say, I don't want those kids on that turf. That turf, even up here in upstate New York, is going to get really hot. Never mind what it's going to be down there in Texas. I mean, there's some very simple things involved here. But what I don't know, Carl, what do you think, too? Because you've also interacted with these people. My sense is you get a lot of project management people involved in these communities as well. And I was trying to think, you know, you got this web of stakeholders, and there's always going to be somebody driving the bus and who's sort of putting down the initial stuff. And I think they're very project management engineering oriented, like you, Carl. And I think they're like, how much can I use it? And how much does it cost me to maintain it? You know, I want to use it. And I want to maintain it. And these other things are more like, okay, well, like, we'll figure that out. Because everything else has to be somewhere between that, right, Carl? So is that what it boils down to in the conversations you've started to have with folks?
There might be a bit of that, but I think the nuance is lost on people. Like Frank, you just explained, synthetic is great for the spring. It's not great for the summer. And that's sort of an if-then thing, that's not a zero or one. Like, okay, we either need synthetic or we need natural. And that's where I think... just a little bit we poked around with sort of K-12 facilities. They want to make a decision and then that's it. Like that's the last we have to think about fields. We can focus on the building and pest control in the building and education of our students. And like Chase is saying, really you need somebody there who's a professional and knows the day-to-day and the week-to-week and the month-to-month activities that will vary based on the season or based on the use. And one thing we got from Chase's proposal when you shared with us last year, Chase, was like, well, we don't understand who's making decisions at community levels. Like, is it just a coach who coaches football and it's just like, yeah, I'll mow the fields and then I'll make all the, you know, like baseball fields. I didn't realize a lot of the baseball coaches end up mowing those sort of high school level, middle school level fields. They're making decisions. They're just a baseball coach and probably have another full-time job, right? So we don't even understand who's making decisions. And that's why it's really important to get this work done, Chase, is like, we know the turf stuff that you should do. It should be easy, But all those other factors, if it's parents, if it's administrators, if it's facility people who are really focused on HVAC or power generators, getting generators or something like that, and they're just mowing the fields, right? Like that's the sort of the black
but this
box.
Is why, but this is why they go to synthetic turf, right? Yeah. Jason, you said it. The assumption is it's no maintenance for synthetic turf, that I can build it and forget it. It's capital money. It's not annual operating dollars. I signed a warranty. The company's going to come for 6 years and make sure it's cared for, right? And so you know it gets at least a little bit of that. But I think the critical point is it's not no maintenance, especially the infills, right? The various amount of infills you can use, the various sports that move the stuff around. But here's my question, since you're on the hot seat here today, brother. This might be the last time we get you. But when you sit down, okay, so they said don't be so progress. So I'm assuming you reach out to people involved in synthetic turf. And I can tell you that when I've sat in the same room giving a natural turf talk after a synthetic turf talk, no knock on the science of synthetic turf, but the guy before me sounded like he was selling a carpet for your living room. The various stitchings and weavings and logos and things you could get on there. And when I brought up safety, everybody was like, what's this guy talking about? wait, there's something wrong with synthetic turf? That's the first part of it. A lot of those people involved in helping inform the decision, they're looking, even the guys at the school grounds level, they're looking to influence that. Did the synthetic turf guys get a little defensive? Are they a little squirrely when it comes to it? Because I know the natural turf guys are a little squirrely about synthetic turf. Are the synthetic turf guys equally a little defensive about it?
No comment. No, I'm joking. Yeah, I mean, they all are, right? They all want to push their product and they all want to push their initiative. But to me, the synthetic turf companies that were really on board from the get-go for my initial ask to be a part of this project are the mm-hmm. ones that truly do care about putting out useful information. Perfect. And unbiased information. Perfect. And so I've started to internally identify who those people are. And to me, I think that's good. Yeah. I think they should do that, and they're all for it, and they understand that things might not benefit them, but they also understand things probably could benefit them. And it's not going to be beneficial to one specific sector, right? There's going to be benefits and disadvantages of everything that we find in the study.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you might as well get used to your success in this project is likely with both sides feeling a little bit upset with you, which is a space Carl and I have inhabited for a number of years. So welcome to the club. We're making up shirts. Carl, we got any questions from the audience on for Chase or any more from you?
Let's see. No questions. One question I have, Chase, is have you guys thought about, you know, like we're talking about the decision-making process and there's going to be a lot of factors. You guys want to just provide the information for communities or school districts to make a decision. Any thought about including AI in there, like a decision-making tool or software that can help? Maybe they just enter a couple things like we have this much money, we have, you know, these weather conditions on a given year. Any thoughts about a tool at the end that they can just sort of put stuff in and it spits out a decision for them?
Yep, absolutely. So that's the end deliverable. That's like our big thing that we're building towards. All this data feeds into a system. They can go in with their specific scenario, their budget, the people they got, the hours of use, whatever, and just spit out a recommendation. That's the end goal. Yep.
That's a home run. And then so basically what's about to happen is before you close the hood, everybody's going to get a chance to look under it and have some influence in what's in there. And then once the person, is it going to be something that person using the tool is going to have to self-identify? It's like, I'm an administrator, I'm a grounds manager, or it doesn't really matter. You just have to enter in the logistics of the district use and money and people and stuff like that.
Yeah, the goal is to identify through earlier objectives of the project who those decision makers are. And honestly, anybody can use the tool, but the idea would be to promote it to the decision makers. Yeah.
All right. Because it's a very contentious issue, Chase. Of course, we like to fight about everything up here in New York. Oh, We're looking for a fight.
Frank, going back to your point, though, we don't have data to support a lot of our things right now, of these arguments. So if I have data and I'm the guy that has to be in the middle of the back and forth, I can just be like, look, this isn't my opinion. This is the data.
That's
so they
right.
might hate that. They might hate
that's
it,
right.
but.
Well, and that's, and I tell you, as we wrap up, that's probably why I've formulated the opinions that I have about this, because these are the things we have data about, right? It's pretty good. You can use these synthetic surfaces pretty consistently. If you manage them, they can take more events than a natural grass system. Maybe not by as much as people think, but there's some data about that. There's data about heat, right? There's data about the high traction, but that's it. You know what I mean? I don't get into the cancer thing. I don't get into the
right.
MRSA thing. I mean, the MRSA thing, they sort of, you know, most of the science refutes it, but there's some science that says there are things that live in that thing. Now, who the hell knows when you got to put cork or whatever stupid thing we're about to put in there.
Yep.
Before we let you go, one more question. Have you, as just a sports turf guy from the old Kentucky days with AJ Powell, heard about the impact microplastic issues in the EU are going to have on synthetic turf, as maybe our listeners are thinking about what the next generation of synthetic turf's going to be filled with if it's infilled?
Yeah, I'm familiar. I think it's like the second largest resource next to tires, actual tires in Europe. They've identified as microplastics or synthetic turf. I don't know to what degree though. I haven't read up on the literature enough to know, is it truly impactful to, you know, humans or animals or whatnot.
Okay.
But it's something that we're considering in the grant as well too. So I mean, we're covering all aspects.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right, Carl. Yep. All right, Chase, thanks for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks, guys.
Thanks a bunch, Chase.
Right,
thanks,
thank
everyone,
you.
for coming today live. And we'll see you guys next Thursday, 10 a.m.
All right. Thanks,
Take
Chase.
Care.
Take care.
See
you, Carl.
Yep.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.